Good evening and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the International History Institute at Boston University and featuring Rutgers University Professor Jackson Lears. Professor Lears' lecture is part of a series titled The Short American Century, 1941 to 2008, Contrasting Views of the Era of American Dominance. We begin with an introduction by Boston University Professor of History and International Relations, Andrew Basevich.
It is my great pleasure to introduce our speaker for this evening, Professor Jackson Lears from Rutgers University. Professor Lears was educated at the University of Virginia, the University of North Carolina, and Yale, where he received his Ph.D. in American Studies in 1979. He is currently the Board of Governors Professor of History at Rutgers and is also the editor-in-chief of a quarterly published at Rutgers, Raritan. He is the author of quite a number of very important books, No Place of Grace, Anti-Modernism and the Transformation of American Culture, Fables of Abundance, A Cultural History of Advertising in America, which won the Los Angeles Times Book Award back in 1995, Something for Nothing, Luck in America, which appeared in 2003 from Viking Penguin, and most recently, Rebirth of a Nation, The Making of a Modern America, 1877 to 1920, that was published just last year by HarperCollins. He's edited a couple of collections of essays, published in all of the leading historical journals, has also regularly contributed to the New Republic, The Nation, the LA Times, the Washington Post, and so on. He was elected in 2009 as a fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. The title of Professor Lear's presentation for this evening is Boots on the Ground, the Anti-Imperial Persuasion in 20th Century American Thought. So, again, thank you very much for joining us this evening. We're very grateful.
Well, thank you, Andy. And thank you all for showing up, as George Bush Sr. recommended. I'm going to begin with a defining moment. Historians love defining moments. This one was the congressional debate over NAFTA in 1993. I don't want to evaluate specific policies, but I want to highlight two contrasting styles of language and thought, two different ways of talking and thinking about American empire. It's important to remember that the early 90s were a key moment in the debate over America's role in the world. History, you may remember, had ended. The Cold War was over. Henry Luce's American century seemed on the verge of uncontested fulfillment at last, but there were troubling signs on the horizon. Most Americans had not participated in the prosperity of the Reagan-Bush era. Two-thirds had seen their wages stagnate or decline. In the corporate workplace, downsizing was the order of the day. In foreign affairs, there was heady exhilaration over a quick victory in the Gulf War, but neoconservatives, who later took to calling themselves Vulcans, had already begun to grumble that we needed to finish the job. More diffuse among the chattering class were fears that without the old enemy, the Soviet Union, life would lack purpose and direction. The citizenry would sink into lassitude. The question was how to sustain the American century after its apparent triumph, how to avoid stasis, maintain momentum. To its advocates, NAFTA would be a mechanism that would move the country forward, as pollsters like to say. NAFTA confirmed the emergence of a post-Cold War vision of American empire. Yet it was squarely in the tradition of soft imperialism, the imperium that looked more like an emporium. To the advocates' arguments, Representative Gingrich of Georgia, this is a vote for history. Every once in a while, there is a magic moment that is larger than politics, it's larger than re-election, it's larger than personal ego. It's a moment when you define the future of the nation and the future of the world, who we are and what we believe in. The future of your country and your children depends on this vote. I am an optimist. As Reagan once said, I believe in dreaming heroic dreams. After all, I'm an American. I choose to vote for American civilization to increase our economic opportunity because I believe in a bigger future, a better future, and a greater chance for all humans to pursue happiness. And I believe reaching out to Mexico is an important first step in that direction. Dan Rostenkowski of Illinois, not to be partisan about this, the Democratic leader at the time, agreed. In this debate, we're telling the world how we view ourselves, whether we welcome change and challenge or whether we fear it. We're sending messages about whether the world's only superpower thinks its best days are in the past or in the future. While we frequently spend many hours in this chamber discussing our nation's flaws, I am nonetheless an optimist. Repeatedly in our history, we've been asked to enlarge America's markets. There have always been doubters, but they've always been proven wrong. Now, let's listen quickly to the opponents. Senator Dorgan of North Dakota, he criticized economic models used to justify NAFTA. They were projections based on self-fulfilling assumptions, he said. The assumptions included no net change in U.S. investment in Mexico, no net change in employment, a mystifying language of expertise that concealed circularities of argument. The opponent's own language tended to be straightforward and specific. Representative Bonier of Michigan asked, how are Mexican workers supposed to buy American cars when a week's wage will barely earn them enough to buy a set of spark plugs? So we get a different style of thought. Instead of abstract, particular. Instead of futurist, historicist. Instead of determinist, pragmatist. On the one side, sweeping generalizations. On the other, lived experience. The pro-NAFTA style encouraged indifference to lived experience. For example, in the common argument that problems will only occur in the transition to the brave new world that would be brought about by NAFTA. Only in the short run, as the advocates said. Russell Baker, writing in the New York Times, had this to say, there is something cruel, offensive, and faintly dishonest in the supporters of NAFTA's argument that any pain felt by the working classes will only be a short-run experience. It's important to notice here the devaluation of the present, of the immediate experience that's going on in the pro-NAFTA arguments, because imperialist thought is almost always teleological. The pro-NAFTA forces did make one historical claim. They invoked the specter of isolationism. As one of the supporters said, outbursts against NAFTA are typical of America's reaction after great conflicts. After proving ourselves over a foreign foe, we retreat from our victory. We fold inward. We brood in suspicion and dread of foreigners. We clamor for a cloistered America. We become a nation unworthy of its victory. The Cold War was a war no less than any other, and we won it. This time, let us not mire ourselves in pointless and self-destructive seclusion. America cannot peep out at the 21st century from a bunker. Representative Shays of Connecticut reminds his colleagues that in August 1941, Americans wanted to isolate themselves and urged Congress to end the draft. But some in Congress knew that the United States could not be an island unto itself, and so they approved continuing the draft by only one vote. This great nation with an economy 20 times the size of Mexico's does not need to fear our neighbors to the south. As it did in 1941, Congress needs to rise to the occasion. So, attacks on isolationism. They're a staple of imperialist arguments throughout the American century, even before Henry Luce's assertion of 1941. We are not in a war to defend American territory. We are in a war to defend and even to promote, encourage, and incite so-called democratic principles throughout the world. 50 years on, Luce's heirs were Republicans and New Democrats who backed NAFTA. But the opponents of NAFTA hark back to the anti-imperialist tradition. They shared common habits of mind and speech, concrete particularity, lived experience. What I want to do is turn to that anti-imperialist tradition, recover a usable past. And in the process, I want to challenge the conventional wisdom, which is practically a default setting, that imperialists are tough-minded and anti-imperialists are sentimental. In fact, the reverse is true. To recover the anti-imperial tradition, to reclaim it for our time, we have to sort out the meanings of two fraught words, both of which have been worn threadbare by polemical use: isolationism and realism. Isolationism clearly is part of the anti-imperial tradition of grounded thought. Realism, though it claims to start from the same place, has often slipped into the service of empire and become part of the vaporous language of global responsibility and inevitable war, until the counterclaims of reality have become too much for the realists to ignore. The original realists were the makers of the U.S. Constitution. They shared a vision of a republic based on assumptions that human nature was flawed, power corrupting, hubris a constant temptation. Power must be decentralized to keep the republic from turning into an empire. They questioned progress. They took a cyclical view rather than a linear view of history. But in the 1890s, during the first imperialist crusade, we saw a fundamental departure from that tradition. Under the banners of regeneration and righteousness, Theodore Roosevelt, Henry Cabot Lodge, and the other imperialists carried the U.S. flag and U.S. occupying forces, not only to the Caribbean, but to the farthest reaches of the Pacific, the Philippine Islands. The Filipinos naively expected liberation when the U.S. took over. They fought back. 10 years of counterinsurgency operations, including torturing suspects, destroying whole villages, maintaining a military presence for decades. This was the denouement of our first experiment in occupying a distant country with an alien culture while trying to quell a determined insurgency. Well, William James was outraged. Damn the United States for its vile conduct in the Philippine Islands, he wrote. And the basis of his anti-imperialism, I want to argue, is really the basis of what I think of as an enduring critique of empire. So I'm going to just go through quickly four features of James's thought that characterize that critique. The first one is pluralism. James wrote a wonderful essay called On a Certain Blindness in Human Beings. He started off telling a story from Robert Louis Stevenson's autobiography, a recollection of how he, Stevenson, and his friends used to walk around with little lanterns under their coats. And they knew that there was a candle in there, but nobody else knew that they were carrying this light around inside. This was an example to James of what so many of us fail to see. In fact, all of us fail to see is what really matters to other people. James also talked about taking the train through the mountains of western North Carolina and being appalled by the devastation that he saw there, devastation wrought by the farmers slashing and burning in order to build their cabins and get their farms set up. He was appalled, he said, until he stopped and talked to one of the farmers who was so proud of what he had done in hacking his way into this wilderness and making a homestead for himself. The point of these stories was, according to James, the difficulty of grasping or even glimpsing other people's inner lives, especially the vital center of being that gave them meaning and purpose. A pluralistic foreign policy sanctioned multiple vital centers, granting legitimacy to local aspirations, even among backward peoples. Imperial foreign policy, in contrast, denied those aspirations in the name of progress, suppressing the Filipinos' own aspirations for independence, while imperialists spoke at home about the blessings of democracy and self-determination. So pluralism is one feature of James's anti-imperialism. Another is radical empiricism, what he called radical empiricism, which involved distrust of orthodox assumptions about reality and also an openness to all kinds of evidence, even the kinds of evidence that weren't scientifically verifiable, and an impatience, above all, an impatience with abstraction. So this is the kind of outlook that would lead you to distrust phrases like little brown brothers or uncivilized melee, and instead prefer the specific, Emilio Aguinaldo. So radical empiricism is the second thing. The third feature is, again, pragmatism. Ideas should be judged by their consequences in everyday life, including the idea of empire, its impact on subject peoples abroad, its impact on domestic life at home. And finally, republicanism, lowercase republicanism, rooted in the founding fathers' fear of empire. As James put it, America puked up its soul in 5 minutes without a hint of squeamishness during the Spanish-American War. Well, America's ancient soul may not have been as pure as James imagined. A lot of messy realities lay behind the textbook phrase, westward expansion, for example. But the 1890s did represent a fundamental departure from lowercase republican tradition. What matters here is not James's historical knowledge, but his style of thought and how profoundly it differed from the imperialist discourse of manifest destiny, the teleological vision of progress that saw America destined to play a divinely ordained role in the sacred drama of world history. It's important to point out here, lest I belabor the obvious, that manifest destiny is a secular version of providence. Traditional Christianity, providence's aims are mysterious, right? The divine will is unknowable to puny humans. But in manifest destiny, destiny is no longer mysterious, but manifest. So what you have here is a worldview that discards Christian humility in the face of God's ways. We now know we are working his will in the world. So to move from empire to anti-empire is to move from vaporous abstractions and euphemisms to plain speech, the language of the Republican tradition. The distrust of concentrated power, executive deceit, the thwarting of popular sovereignty at home and abroad, the distrust of the too easy resort to force along with the painful awareness of its consequences. The refusal of euphemism, what might be called pragmatic realism. But realism is a slippery word. It can work both sides of the street. In the 1910s, you begin to see a shift in imperial rhetoric from the moralistic bluster of Teddy Roosevelt to the lower-keyed idiom spoken by young men who call themselves realists. Walter Lippmann was a key figure here. At the age of 8, he saw Teddy Roosevelt campaigning at Saratoga Springs, and he never forgot it. He never got over the excitement evoked by Teddy Roosevelt's energy and vitality. And when Lippmann was at Harvard, he met up with William James. After he graduated, a number of his contemporaries, and he founded the magazine, The New Republic. They were all young men fired by fascination with action, especially as the U.S. drifted toward entry in World War I. After the declaration of war, Lippmann was filled with ardor and a desire for engagement, but not direct military engagement. He wrote a letter to the Secretary of War, Newton Baker, and I quote, "What I want to do is to devote all my time to studying and speculating on the approaches to peace and the reactions from the peace. Do you think you can get me an exemption on such highfalutin grounds?" Well, it turned out that Newton Baker could, in fact, get him an exemption, and did. It's a familiar pattern here. Grandiose dreams of war intellectuals tend to be hatched far from the scene of battle. Lippmann secured a job in the Inquiry, Wilson's forerunner to the National Security Council. It was dominated by liberal realists who spoke a language pruned of hyper-masculine excess, rhetorically pragmatic and tough-minded, but as wedded to grandiose goals as ever. John Dewey, as well as the editors at the New Republic, urged pragmatic adjustment to the realities of U.S. intervention as a way to accomplish Wilson's larger, noble goal, the remaking of the entire world on the U.S. model, the least realistic goal imaginable. The pattern of realistic rhetoric and unrealistic aims would characterize interventionist doctrine for decades. The sharpest critic of it was Randolph Bourne, a hunchback Jersey guy who caught the contradictions deftly. who eviscerated the moral pretensions of the war makers and the empty consequences of their realism. And I quote, "The results of war on the intellectual class are already apparent. Their thought becomes little more than a description and a justification of what is going on. They turn upon any rash one who continues idly to speculate. Once the war is on, the conviction spreads that individual thought is helpless, that the only way one can count is as a cog in a great wheel. There is no good holding back. We are told to dry our unnoticed and ineffective tears and plunge into the great work. Not only is everyone forced into line, but the new certitude becomes idealized. It is a noble realism which opposes itself to futile obstruction and the cowardly refusal to face facts. This realistic boast is so loud and sonorous that one wonders whether realism is always a stern and intelligent grappling with realities. May it not be sometimes a mere surrender to the actual, an abdication of the ideal through a sheer fatigue from intellectual suspense?" Well, the Versailles Treaty conspicuously failed to embody Wilsonian ideals. Lippmann was bitterly disillusioned. He retreated to his tower office at the New York World newspaper, from which he directed the course of empire in the 1920s. At one point, he observed, "We continue to think of ourselves as a kind of great peaceable Switzerland, whereas we are, in fact, a great expanding world power. Our imperialism is more or less unconscious." Well, this is a familiar and recurring realist fallacy, that is, the notion that the United States is a big bumbling giant that doesn't really know what it's doing, and that is deluded by high ideals, and it's just really stumbling about unconsciously in the world. Meanwhile, Lippmann's up in his tower, down on the street, disillusionment with great crusades, wars to end war, and a rise of pacifism, especially in liberal Protestant churches. The crash of 1929 and the coming of the Great Depression turned churches to the left on social issues, even as they clung to ideals of nonviolence. A young Lutheran pastor in Detroit, Reinhold Niebuhr, found himself increasingly frustrated by what seemed to him to be sentimental evasions of his fellow Christians, who wanted social justice but seemed afraid to fight for it. Niebuhr's Augustinian Christianity, his sense of inherent human imperfection, call it original sin, he did, led him to distrust all utopian schemes that disavowed the use of force. And out of this distrust was born one of his truly major works. He has many, but one truly important one, Moral Man and Immoral Society, published in 1932. Moral Man and Immoral Society. The thesis is in the title. Nations will always be vain, proud, complacent, and hypocritical. They cannot be held to the same standards as individuals. The elimination of violence between nations or social groups is a futile goal. Violence is not inherently unethical if it's deployed in the service of what Niebuhr called equal justice, the most rational ultimate aim for society. And I'm quoting, "A social conflict which aims at greater equality has a moral justification which must be denied to efforts which aim at the perpetuation of privilege. A war for the emancipation of a nation, a race, or a class is thus placed in a different moral category from the use of power for imperial rule or class dominance." Well, there were problems here with this formulation. Niebuhr had already devoted several scathing pages to the hypocrisy of the Spanish-American War, the claims of liberation, and the like. If nations were always hypocritical, could not they easily cloak their sordid aims in robes of righteousness? The question could only be answered empirically with respect to specific circumstances, but even then, of course, the answers would be debatable. There was another problem. Niebuhr did not acknowledge that militarists as well as pacifists could conflate individual morality and national morality. His realism could have been used against imperial ideas of national resolve, toughness, or responsibility. against fears of cowardice and weakness or even the appearance of cowardice and weakness. But that was not the sort of demystification he had in mind. Still, during the 30s, Niebuhr's Christian realism did provide a bracing counterpoint to liberal pieties. His resurrection of original sin, his recognition that unresolved conflict was at the heart of human existence, and above all, his celebration of what he called the spiritual discipline against resentment. This discipline involved making a distinction between the evils of a social system and the individuals involved in it. Niebuhr was a towering figure in American religious history. His role in foreign policy is a bit more problematic. He sometimes lost sight of the recognition that the evil in the foe is also in the self, which was easy to do in the 30s and 40s. For a long time, Niebuhr was at the center of a story that historians like to tell about the mid-century decades. A small band of liberal realists saved the country from pacifists and isolationists in the 30s and from hysterical cold warriors in the 40s and 50s, steering a sober middle course, a pragmatic empirical alternative to hazy abstractions and ideologies on both left and right. Well, this was a kind of centrist fairy tale. There was a lot of truth to it, but it needs complication. And the way I want to complicate it is first by reconsidering the isolationists and showing they're very much in the boots-on-the-ground tradition of anti-imperial thought. And I also want to complicate things by reconsidering the realists and showing how easily their worldview could meld with imperial ideas and with the imperialist ethos until they recovered their footing and got their boots back on the ground, too. So first, the isolationists. I'm only going to mention a couple. Senator Robert Taft, Mr. Republican from Ohio. Taft's worldview shows up in a lot of different ways, but one of them is his response to The American Century, the essay that Henry Luce published in early 1941. Taft was appalled, and I quote, "Luce and his friends seem to contemplate an Anglo-American alliance perpetually ruling the world. Frankly, the American people don't want to rule the world," said Taft, "and we are not equipped to do it. Such imperialism is wholly foreign to our ideals of democracy and freedom. We may think we are better than other people and more equipped to rule, but will they think so?" Fairly straightforward question. Republican ideals, lowercase republican, rooted in realistic suspicions of power, fears of executive tyranny, secrecy, and deceit. All of this shaped Taft's critique of interventionism. The other figure I want to mention just quickly in this connection with isolationism is the historian Charles Beard, who engaged in a thoroughgoing materialist and historicist critique of the imperial tradition, both hard imperialism and soft imperialism. In his very interesting book, published in 1940, A Foreign Policy for the United States, he provides very skeptical portraits of Teddy Roosevelt and Alfred Thayer Mahan, the theorist and the practitioner of empire in the 1890s. Mahan's views were pretty straightforward. The nation must expand or die, claim its advantages by violence if necessary, if diplomacy fails. And Beard wrote, "Perhaps in the whole history of the country there had never been a more cold-blooded resolve to put over on the people such a grand policy in spite of their recalcitrance, ignorance, and provincialism." Beard saw FDR as a legitimate heir of Teddy Roosevelt and Mahan. "Distracting public attention from domestic problems by engaging in foreign quarrels, sustaining imperial rivalries in Asia, seeking surreptitiously, as in the Kearney incident, to enter the war in Europe." Beard's alternative to interventionism was what he called continental Americanism, resistance to foreign intrusions over here, avoidance of foreign entanglements over there. One can quarrel with this formulation on empirical grounds, but few interventionists did. Most deployed the vaporous language of global responsibility and technological determinism. And one cannot deny that Beard's continental Americanism was consistent with Republican tradition, the distrust of the impact of imperial power at home and abroad. Beard foresaw the continuity of interventionist foreign policy from World War II through the Cold War. The Truman Doctrine of 1947 promised an open-ended commitment to global responsibility. It turned the struggle between left and right in Greece into a struggle between freedom and slavery. The U.S., Truman asserted, was committed to support free peoples everywhere who are resisting subjugation by armed minorities or outside pressures. Beard was skeptical. The Democrats are playing the old game of crisis and trying to wring one more victory out of the bloody shirt. It was, he thought, part of a larger agenda, perpetual war for perpetual peace. So much for the isolationists. Now I want to talk about the realists. The realists that I want to engage are Niebuhr again, Lippmann again, George Kennan, and William Fulbright, from the 1930s through the 1960s. We'll start with Niebuhr. He is indeed a Jamesian. He was, according to the Christian Century, reviewing one of his books, nothing if not a radical empiricist. And this was because, in part at least, of his concern for taking evidence seriously, even if it was not scientifically verifiable. He was pragmatic, too, in his concern for the actual consequences of beliefs. And I would argue that both of those fed into his awareness of evil, which made him uniquely sensitive to the Nazi horror that was developing in the late 1930s. In May 1941, he told a story about a friend of his who had gotten a contract to publish a book in Germany. And a clause in the contract stated that no Jew shall have anything to do with its manufacture or its publication. Niebuhr said, that is the kind of world we'd have to live in if we don't stop Hitler. But it's also important to remember that he's virtually alone in this perception at the time, and certainly among U.S. policymakers. So Niebuhr, we have to grant, I think, a kind of higher realism there in that sensitivity. But at the same time, Moral Man and Immoral Society had issued a blank check for violence in the name of equal justice. And this check was underwritten by Niebuhr's apocalyptic expectations from 1933 on. He believed that the rise of fascism meant the world was headed for Armageddon. And Niebuhr's own kind of dark, messianic vision was linked to his own restless personal style. And I quote his biographer, Richard Fox. He was afraid of keeping still, pondering endlessly. He thought he would dry up, lose the vitality that he never ceased to claim as the crucial human attribute. So here we can see the parallels, I think, personally, between Niebuhr and Roosevelt, Lippmann, and other realist intellectuals for whom doing something was always better than doing nothing. Still, Niebuhr criticized Luce's American Century as a new white man's burden. Luce doesn't know, said Niebuhr, that our salvation must be worked out in fear and trembling. The U.S. must shoulder world responsibilities, including imperial ones, but we are threatened as much by our own pretensions to virtue as by world disorder. So the question remained, what effect did the awareness of our own capacity for evil have on the conduct of foreign policy? Niebuhr was ambivalent. He signed the Federal Council of Churches' protest against the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but he apologized privately for doing so, saying the bomb was a quintessential example, and I quote, of how much evil we have to do in order to do good. This assumed, of course, the necessity for unconditional surrender. After the war, he equated Stalin with Hitler in 1946, said he was another madman bent on world domination, trying to frighten us into concessions, and that the only way to avoid war was not to fear it too much. Henry Luce loved that. He put Niebuhr in Life magazine under the headline, "A distinguished theologian declares America must prevent the conquest of Germany and Western Europe by unscrupulous Soviet tyranny." Niebuhr was embarrassed, backed off, and said that, in fact, we ought to leave Eastern Europe to the Soviet Union on realist grounds, and in his other writings proceeded to emphasize the futility of military responses, the inanity of American ideology, and the primacy of economic aid. He fretted about growing militarism, attacked right-wing fantasies of preventive war, and yet still worried that the hydrogen bomb would turn college students into pacifists. Throughout the early Cold War, Niebuhr was haunted by a monochromatic vision of communism. Hordes, and I quote, of faceless men who are immune to every form of moral and political suasion. So anti-communist paranoia undermines Niebuhr's tendencies to restraint. But as the hysteria of the early 50s subsides, Niebuhr's realism reasserts itself. And by 1965, he's a sharp critic of the Vietnam War. The question is, how much did Niebuhr's rhetoric temper U.S. imperial ambitions, and how much did he provide rhetorical sanction for them, as he does for the likes of David Brooks and Barack Obama? With Obama's Oslo speech still a green memory, the question continues to assert itself. Okay, now Lippmann. In the 30s and 40s, he's working his way toward classical realpolitik, from effective pacifism, as he called it, in the mid-30s, to calls for regenerative war in June 1940. Away with soft vices and towards stern virtues. He endorsed Franklin Roosevelt's economic measures versus Japan in the summer of 1941, knowing that demands for an open door in Asia would intensify rivalries with Japan and with the other imperial powers. A realist would have seen the double standard in comparing the open door with the Monroe Doctrine. Lippmann did not. But he was more consistent in U.S. foreign policy, Shield of the Republic, which he published in 1943. It was an attempt to steer between sentimental one-worldism, missionary imperialism, and the Fortress America mentality. Keep the post-war alliance, ensure the Atlantic Highway stays open. And when he talked about a world society, which would become the UN, he said the constitution of this world society should not be based on the idea that everything is everybody's business. We must not write into the constitution of the world society a license to universal intervention. So he showed a growing tendency to counsel restraint against post-45 muscle flexing. Great as it is, American power is limited, he wrote. Within its limits, it will be greater or less dependent on the ends for which it is used. And his rising realism surfaced in his critiques of containment policy, of NATO, of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and of the Vietnam War. He rejected accusations of appeasement against those who were reluctant to commit troops to Cuba, Laos, and Vietnam. This was too serious a business for talk of regeneration through bloodshed, he said. It was appalling to him that people in government and outside it seemed to believe we should shed a little blood to prove we're virile men. This was nonsense. I don't think old men ought to promote wars for young men to fight. So Vietnam was part of the overreaching pattern since World War II. It was time to pull back. If it is said that this is isolationism, I would say yes, it is isolationism, if recognizing the limits of our power is isolationism. Now, a more capacious realism, perhaps, combines Niebuhr's ethical seriousness and Lippmann's restraint. You find this in Kennan and Fulbright. Kennan begins as a militant Cold Warrior in the guise of a realist, and you can see this in the shrillness of the sources of Soviet conduct, which is the essay he writes in Foreign Affairs in 1947 that provides the rationale for containment policy, particularly in its emphasis on the implacable fanaticism bred by communist ideology, its commitment to an inevitable triumph over capitalism. Don't be misled by conciliatory gestures, he said. Basically, the antagonism remains. It is postulated. That is, it is written. Therefore, it must happen. And he concluded his essay with a providential flourish, a certain gratitude to a providence which, by providing the American people with this implacable challenge, has made their entire security as a nation dependent on pulling themselves together and accepting the responsibilities of moral and political leadership that history plainly intended them to bear. But Kennan came to regret this doctrine. As Lippmann predicted, it became a prescription for overextended global commitments and rickety alliances with dictators. And Kennan himself saw this almost immediately. The Truman Doctrine, in fact, had begun to concern him, and he reflected on this later and said it looked to him like an example of a curious American tendency to search at all times for a single external center of evil to which all our troubles can be attributed, rather than to recognize that they might be spread over multiple sources of resistance to our purposes and undertakings, and that these sources might be relatively independent of each other. So we're looking at a pluralistic perspective there, multiplicity of issues and problems. Kennan becomes the prophet of discriminating restraint, and like other realists, he still tends to see the U.S. foreign policy as a product of overweening pride and perverse idealism. Like them, he overlooks the role of economic interests, the search for markets, for resources, for investment opportunities. But his emphasis on discrimination, especially with respect to weapons, made him a powerful critic of the nuclear arms race and of reliance on nukes as an instrument of foreign policy. The language of nuclear policy was the opposite of Republican plain speech, quantitative, denatured technobabble. Nuclear weapons were the perfect example, Kennan thought, of the absolutist tendency to embrace wars of annihilation and doctrines of unconditional surrender. Man, he said, was a cracked vessel whose imperfections would always curtail and confound his aspirations. So the mature Kennan rejected all messianic concepts of America's role in the world, as he put it, all prattle about manifest destiny and the American century. He knew all too well, as he said, that there is, as Reinhold Niebuhr so brilliantly and persuasively argued, no power, individual or collective, without some associated guilt. And he took on some of that guilt himself and acknowledged his role in creating this foreign policy that he later came to deplore. By the time he wrote those words in his 90s, Kennan had come a long way from the providentialist assumptions of his younger days. And yet, secular providence remained a keystone of the American civil religion. The corollary assumption to it was that power and virtue were the same. Any realist worth the name had to challenge this hubris, as Fulbright did in his great book, The Arrogance of Power, which was published in 1966. America is the most fortunate of nations, he wrote, implying that our preeminent position in the world was a product of luck rather than divine will. Yet America was losing its perspective on what was within its capacity to control and what was beyond it. Providential ideas reinforced the illusion of omnipotence. Fulbright knew that this God-intoxicated mentality had been a staple of colonialism for centuries, and that an American version of it had been justifying overseas intervention since at least the Spanish-American War. He detested the bullying sanctimony of this tradition, and he detected alternatives to it in the American past. There were, he believed, two main American traditions of thinking about the national destiny, two fundamentally different sensibilities. The one that embodied the arrogance of power was embodied in the Roosevelt corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which appointed the U.S. the moral policeman of the Western Hemisphere. The other, more humane tradition animated Lincoln's second inaugural address, which magnanimously interpreted the Civil War as a national expiation for the sin of slavery rather than a triumph of Northern virtue over Southern perfidy. In Fulbright's view, the architects of American foreign policy in the 60s were stuck in the self-righteous tradition of the Roosevelt corollary. they badly needed to reconnect with the more generous and self-critical examples of governance from their own past. Virtue unleashed was at best an annoyance, at worst a holy terror, Fulbright said. For starters, not everyone had the same notion of moral regeneration. So, instead of this intrusive moralism, Fulbright proposed what he identified as a conservative policy. The conservative policy inspired by Burke, Castlereagh, and Metternich. They believed in the preservation of links between the past and the future because they profoundly mistrusted abstract ideas, he wrote, and because they did not think themselves or any other men qualified to play God. Fulbright shared this historicist perspective with these European conservatives. It was not a simple-minded belief that one could extract discrete lessons from the past, but it was a recognition that the power of the past pressed inescapably into the future, shaping policy decisions in ways that messianic utopians only dimly understood. A sense of history tempered grandiose delusions. Great nations, like great individuals, acknowledged their own fallibility. They admitted mistakes. This became crucial for Fulbright as he watched the American presence increase in Vietnam and heard critics of the war accused of giving aid and comfort to the enemies of the United States. On the contrary, wrote Fulbright, criticism was an act of patriotism. Refusal to acquiesce in mistaken military adventures was neither a failure to support our troops nor a symptom of national weakness. It was a sign of national maturity and magnanimity. And magnanimity, for Fulbright, was the key criterion of genuine national greatness. He summoned Winston Churchill, Walter Lippmann, George Kennan, and Charles de Gaulle to testify that great power was most effectively exercised through enunciation rather than assertion. And perhaps the most effective renunciation was the open acknowledgement of error. Fulbright joined Kennan in arguing that the possession of unlimited power demanded the cultivation of unprecedented restraint. Fulbright's views gradually acquired legitimacy, largely through the press of circumstance. By 1968, when polls indicated that a bare majority of Americans had turned against the war, more than a few wondered how the disaster had come about. The idea that we had been mistakenly fighting indigenous nationalism, which happened to be communist, rather than imported communism, which happened to be nationalist, provided a powerful explanation for the failure of the interventionist enterprise in Vietnam. It also had the merit of being true. In the universities, the mainstream press, and even some of the corridors of government power, Fulbright became celebrated as something of a seer. His skeptical outlook spread during the early 1970s as revelations of government mendacity multiplied and provoked a broader reevaluation of imperial hubris. Eventually, the waste of life in Vietnam led Americans of all ages and social backgrounds, even many members of Congress, to question the equation of power and virtue that had sustained a foreign policy of global intervention since World War II. But that sort of self-questioning did not survive for long. Almost as soon as the last helicopter left the roof of the American embassy in Saigon, the American right began to construct a revanchist narrative of American defeat. Like the tale told by German rightists in 1919, this was a story of a stab in the back. According to this fantastic account, the war effort was not thwarted on the battlefield but on the home front by the anti-war movement and their allies in the so-called liberal media. To our shame, we Americans simply lacked the political will to back our boys to victory. So after years of inadequate support, we finally packed them up and sent them home. A noble cause, in Reagan's phrase, was undone by faint-hearted liberals. The story of the stab in the back suited Republican Party operatives and policy intellectuals who took to calling themselves neoconservatives and a smaller group, Vulcans. The Vulcans were led by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, both Ford administration officials who had endured the humiliating spectacle of the last Americans leaving Saigon. They were resolved from the outset to invade Iraq and unseat Saddam Hussein. They had many motives, but one big one, the desire to erase the memory of the Vietnamese defeat by doing it right this time. The post-9/11 atmosphere created the opportunity to resurrect Cold War narratives. The justification of military intervention is a combination of self-defense and sanctified mission, imperialism as idealism. Political success required, as we know, systematic lying about the present, about weapons of mass destruction, about alleged links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, and also about the past. So, the lesson of this, according to the Vulcans, was that the failure to support our troops could have calamitous consequences. And so, public amnesia spread, forbidding the remembrance of failure, forbidding the realization that the plan to remake an entire region through military force is a revival of deeply rooted American delusions. The architects of our current foreign policy remain trapped in their messianic dreams of their predecessors, imprisoned by the same arrogance that trapped us in Vietnam 40 years ago. So, what I want to suggest is that we do, in fact, need to recover that usable past and turn it into a usable present, to find anti-imperial spokesmen with their boots on the ground. Some of them might even be in this room. But all of them would know that among the corruptions of empire, few are more damaging to the body politic than the corruptions of language and thought. Thank you all for your patience.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Rutgers University Professor Jackson Lears. Professor Lears' lecture was presented by the International History Institute at Boston University, part of its series titled The Short American Century, 1941 to 2008, Contrasting Views of the Era of American Dominance. Professor Lears was introduced by Boston University Professor of History and International Relations, Andrew Basevich. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Jared Mooney, with help from Alden Fertig and Jim Kiesling. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.